Would you like to know why the riots are happening now? In this episode of The Leadersmith, I'm going to try to explain why. I think I have an answer. Stay tuned.
In a world of incompetent bosses, micromanagers, and petty tyrants, one management professor claims that he can help you become the kind of leader that you would want to follow. You are listening to The Leadersmith. Now, here is your host, Darren Gurdis.
Okay, so what I'm recording here is actually for my class. And then I thought, you know what? This is good stuff that I'm going to put on my podcast so that other people can ride along. My class had just finished reading a book by Robert Cialdini called Influence, Science, and Practice. And in that book, Cialdini explains what was going on with the riots. Now, I didn't know when I set the course up for the summer that it was going to be what was going to happen was going to happen. Nobody could anticipate that. So I took out some sections in chapter six and chapter seven. I took out some slides that I talk about usually in class, but they're kind of hard to address online. And so because this is an online class, I have little video clips of things that are important along the way, but I don't. So I took it out because I just felt like, you know, I wanted to be gentle with these things. So there's one about how we view police, and then there's another one that's talking about how and why riots happen. So I'm going to talk, and I'm going right from my slides here. So in chapter six, this is again Cialdini's Influence, Science, and Practice, pages 188 to 190. He's talking about a study of authority in uniforms. And so a person asks others to pick up trash or move elsewhere. In the first group, there's somebody wearing ordinary street clothes. In the second group, it's somebody wearing a security guard uniform. And so many more obeyed the person that, or the man or the woman that was in the uniform. There is another study of police uniforms in uniform. They are rated as, this is just people rating them, as more fair, more helpful, more intelligent, more honest, and good, which is really interesting in light of what's going on right now. But that's what was going on in that study. That's page 189 if you're interested. But the study is not just uniforms. There are a number of ways that we attribute more to some people than others. So, for example, there was a study where who would cross the street against traffic. And so if a man in a business suit crossed the street in traffic, as opposed to a man just wearing a work shirt and blue jeans, 3.5 times as many people followed the man in the suit. So we're attributing something to that, what he's wearing, and then irrationally, we're going with that as opposed to with the other. And so what you wear actually has something to say about how people attribute you. I mean, we say don't judge a book by a cover, but we do. That's what human beings do. And then I show this little clip from a TV show called Head Games, where an average person walks into a, I think it was a Subway or some kind of restaurant like that, and says, "Hey, can I have that seat?" And the people are like, "No, get that seat over there." But then the same person is wearing a police uniform. When the same person wears a police uniform, they then, sure, I'll go over there. And they get up and they move, because we give this deference to authority, to the uniform, to the badge. And that's just how people function. Now, there's a raging debate about whether it should be, or is it too much, or whatever, but this is just how people function. In uniform, again, they're rated as more fair, helpful, intelligent, honest, and good. Now, that's in contrast to what we've been experiencing or viewing over the last few weeks. I mean, I'm looking at a headline here where Defund the Police is written in large letters on the street, and municipalities are seriously talking about that as a backlash to it. Okay, and when I talked about this in class, I used to show this little clip from the Baltimore riots, from CNN on the Baltimore riots, and what was going on, where the police are just being targets of aggression. They're not doing anything because their hands are tied. And, you know, I have to update this now to show what's happened in New York the last few days, where, you know, there's policemen being beaten by the rioters, part caught up in a mob mentality, and part people really are fed up with something, and part opportunism, I'm sure. Okay, so that was from chapter six, with the way that we see the police. And the other one, the more important one, is from chapter seven. So he was talking about, and this is right from the book, Influence, Science, and Practice, again, where in chapter seven, he's talking about revolutions and when they happen. And so I'm going to read this. So if I sound like I'm reading, I am. Perhaps the most prominent, so before I say that, so the idea is this, there's newly experienced scarcity is what is going to cause people to rise up. It's not that people are just down and oppressed for so long and they just can't take it anymore. It's not that. No, they've gotten a taste of something other than that, and now it feels like it's been taken away. Okay, and so here, the most prominent proponent of this argument is James C. Davies, who states that we are most likely to find revolutions at a time when a period of improving economic and social conditions is followed by short, sharp reversal in those conditions. Let me pause for a second. So if you're in the Black community, you probably look at the Obama years as that period of improving conditions. And I'm not going to give commentary on that, but you had a Black president and you probably felt this because the media narrative has been, hey, we have the first Black this, the first female that. The identity politics that was played particularly on the left was very strong. And so it looks like this improving conditions. People on the other side of that divide are not seeing it the same way. But let's just say, so if you see it as improving conditions and then you have Trump, that's bad. But it gets worse. Just listen. Thus, it is not the traditionally most downtrodden people, those who have come to see their deprivation as part of the natural order of things, who are especially likely to revolt. Instead, revolutionaries are more likely to be those who have been given at least some taste of a better life. When the economic and social improvements that they have experienced and come to expect suddenly become less available, they desire them more than ever and often rise up violently to secure them. Okay, so that is from the text. And so I think what we're seeing is that same scarcity effect, the promise being pulled away. So here he's talking about what happened in the past, the racial conflict in America's cities during the mid-1960s represents a case in point that many of us can recall. At the time, it was not uncommon to hear the question, why now? It didn't seem to make sense that within their 300-year history, most of which had been spent in servitude and much of the rest in privation, American Blacks would choose the socially progressive 60s as a time to revolt. Indeed, Davies points out, the two decades after World War II had brought dramatic political and economic gains to the Black population. In 1940, Blacks faced stringent legal restrictions in such areas as housing, transportation, and education. Moreover, even when the amount of education was the same, the average Black family earned only a bit more than half of the amount of its counterpart white family that their counterpart white family earned. 15 years later, much had changed. So it wasn't during that time that we see this revolting, but when we see something else, and this is really interesting. Economic advances had been made too. Black family income had risen from 56% to 80% of that of a comparatively educated white family. Still, another type of downturn occurred within the Black populace in economic progress. In 1962, the income of a Black family had slid back to the 74% of that of a similarly educated white family. By Davies' argument, the most illuminating aspect of this 74% figure is not that it represented a long-term increase in prosperity from pre-war levels, but that it represented a short-term decline from the flush levels of the mid-1950s. In 1963 came the Birmingham riots, and in staccato succession, scores of violent demonstrations building toward the major upheavals of Watts, Newark, and Detroit. So what he's saying is that they were gaining from 56% to 80%, but then it eroded a bit in the early 1960s and was down to 74%. And they're seeing, losing ground. They're feeling that. And then other events going on, like Martin Luther King's assassination, you're tangibly feeling this this reaction to like, hey, we're losing ground. This is being taken away from us. And so you're feeling this newly experienced scarcity. So I think Cialdini is onto something. So we'll talk about, in my class, we would talk about the Baltimore riots in 1968. And then I would compare it in the last couple of years to the Baltimore riots of 2015, where you see Freddie Gray. And so what's going on there is they're feeling that from the Obama years. And then they're seeing, wait, this brutality. And so Baltimore is aflame. We're seeing this again with George Floyd protest right now. So when you see the riots here, something's going on. And I have to update my PowerPoints to talk about that. He talks about it like this, that the optimal conditions, and this is from my PowerPoint, they do not come from the continually downtrodden. They happen when those who have been gaining improvements stagnate. Just like, and so part of this is the reaction to Trump in 2017. The riots in 1960s Baltimore and New York are very similar to the riots that have happened in Ferguson and in Baltimore and now in many cities in light of George Floyd. Okay, so, and when I talked about the Baltimore riots, I would also talk about this. I would compare, the source was Mother Jones, who was talking about Maryland and the number of arrests in Maryland, fourth in the nation, as opposed to, and you compared that, what was going on in Maryland to an income inequality in Maryland, and you compare it across the country, they're very high. But you can compare that, you know, the social conditions in Baltimore across places like New Delhi and Johannesburg and other places, and it's bad. I mean, it's really bad. Washington Post, 8 Baltimore neighborhoods, the life expectancy rate is worse than that in Syria. Okay, so it's pretty bad. So we're talking about the Baltimore riots, but, you know, it's hard to explain something like that just in PowerPoints, and I didn't have a video segment, so I was like, maybe I'll withdraw it. And I'm kicking myself now, because now when we look at Chauvin on the neck of George Floyd, you know, some people will look at this as an individual incident. That's not what's going on in the Black community. They're seeing this as exactly the same thing that we just said. We're making progress, and we're really making progress. And this newly experienced scarcity. Wait, we're going back to that. They feel like a counter revolution. They're making progress in the media. They're making progress in academia. There's a new definition of racism that is so more expansive and systemic. That is a very different thing. And if they're feeling like they're making this progress and it's withdrawn, now that makes sense of why the riots are where they are. Now, the book was really interesting as well. He went on to talk about the coup with Gorbachev. Now, I remember this coup with Gorbachev. I was actually on my way to college in the car listening to it with my parents going to college. And so what happened was, after years of hardline dictatorships, Gorbachev was actually kind of loosening up. And then there was a coup where some of the hardliners were going to seize him and put him out of power. So again, let me read this, because this relates directly to what we're talking about. So this is page 216, if you're at all interested in checking this. So Time Magazine editor Lance Morrow described his own reaction similarly. Quote, "At first, the coup seemed to confirm the norm. The news administered a dark shock, followed by immediate depressed sense of resignation. Of course, the Russians must revert to their essential selves, to their own history. Gorbachev and Glasnost were an aberration, and now we're back to the fatal normality." But that's not what happened. Okay, so something changed drastically within, and I'm quoting again, within hours of the junta's announcement, thousands were in the streets, erecting barricades, confronting armed troops, surrounding tanks, and defying curfews. The uprising was so swift, so massive, so unitary in its opposition to any retreat from the gains of Glasnost, that after only 3 riotous days, the astonished officials relented, surrendering their power and pleading for mercy from Chairman Gorbachev. Had they been students of history or psychology, the failed plotters would not have been so surprised by the tidal wave of popular resistance that swallowed their coup. From the vantage point of either discipline, they could have learned an invariant lesson, and this is it. Freedoms, once granted, will not be relinquished without a fight. And I think that's what's going on here. There's a palpable sense of there's this freedom that's been taken away from us, or not so much that there's freedom, but it's not just I'm tired of this. I think it is we're regressing. We've been making such progress, and then we had Trump. Oh, and then we see this, and when they see this picture, and I can't speak for everyone, but for many of my Black friends, what they told me was when they see this, they see themselves in that picture. So that's what's going on there. That's why this is happening now. And I want to tell you one more story, because this is very similar to the story with Gorbachev. So I've been to the country of Lithuania a number of times. It's on the Baltic. It's a very tiny little country. But I was there in 2001 in a conference in the Seimas. That's the Lithuanian parliament. And so they only got their freedom from the Soviets in 1990. And you can look this up. If you Google Lithuanian freedom 1990, you'll find the Lithuanian, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Republic of Lithuania page. And it's in English for you, so you can read what's going on. So what happened was they said, you know what? Let me read this. On March 11th, 1990, one of the most important events in modern Lithuanian history, the Supreme Council of the Republic of Lithuania adopted an act on the restoration of the independent state of Lithuania after 5 decades of occupation by the Soviet Union. Remember, it was Gorbachev's leniency and operating differently that kind of was stirring this, okay? And they looked in the Soviet Constitution and it said, yeah, we're a bunch of different countries who voluntarily have come together. Well, it wasn't exactly voluntary, but they said, well, we're voluntarily come together, so we'd like out. And so they proposed this act. Well, shortly thereafter, tanks started rolling on Vilnius, the capital city of Lithuania. And so the Soviets sent Russian tanks. Immediately, the people flooded into the streets and they protected people in the Seimas, their leaders in the Seimas. They spanned the Seimas like rings deep, like 6, 8, 10, 12 people deep, holding arms around the Seimas. If they were going to lose their freedom, it would be literally over their dead bodies. That's what they were doing. And the Soviets backed down. Now, I talked to a member of parliament in there. Now, this is guts. They just broke away from one of two superpowers in the world. And they're inside the Seimas. The tanks are there. They have no weapons. He told me he was literally unscrewing the railings so they would have weapons, something in their hands to be able to fight with when the Soviets got into the building. That is amazing. But it's the same principle. It's the newly experienced scarcity. I think that's what was driving the Lithuanians. It's what drove the Russians. I think it's what happened in the 60s. I think that analysis is accurate. And I think it's also what you see or what you're experiencing right now. Okay, so I want to end with this. And I talked about this once before, but I think it's really important. The first law of pure performance. There's a great book where the three laws of performance. The first law of performance is how people perform correlates to how situations occur to them. It doesn't matter if it's true or not. Like if you look at the statistics on how many blacks are killed by police as opposed to white or whatever, there's two different stories between the statistics and what I'm hearing from my black friends, but it doesn't matter. This is what they feel. This is what, I mean, they believe because of experience that this is what's going to happen to them. And it's hard to override what you feel, what you've experienced, right? So how this occurs to them is telling them that something's being taken away and they're rising up. Now, I could be wrong, but that's what the book is telling us, and it was too important of a teaching point to just let go. So I hope that helps and adds some extra nuance to everything that we've been going through in the text. If you're listening into the podcast, this is primarily to my students, but I hope that you will benefit too. So that is a quotation for contemplation today, the first law of performance. How people perform correlates with how situations occur to them. And if you remember that, you can now have some empathy and you can deal with the situation as it is.